Welcome back to Beyond the Call. I'm your host, Jeremy Hutt, and I'm also chairman of Veterans on Duty. And today we're going to be sitting down with Senator Eric Schmidt. He is a senator from Missouri, and he's going to be talking a little bit about his time here in the Senate. He serves on the Senate Armed Services Committee, serves on the Commerce Committee, and he's really a leader in this policy fight, fighting for a nation that is safe, strong, and free. So I'm very thankful for him, and we dive into some really interesting topics today. Talked a little bit about his family history. We talked about his favorite St. Louis Cardinals. Tune in, you'll see it all. Well, thank you so much, Senator. I really appreciate you joining us. It's such an honor to be able to sit here and kind of hear a little bit of your story and more about what you're doing here in the Senate. I wanted to start off because you have an interesting family background. Your grandfather served in the Army. I wanted to hear a little bit about that and what inspired you to decide to run for office and to serve in elected office here in D.C.
Yeah, my grandfather, my Grandpa Schmidt, was from mid-Missouri. And was drafted into World War II and served in the 44th Infantry Unit. They had so many days of combat. Actually, they were on one of the first units to head back on it. I think it was the Queen Elizabeth on these big, like, kind of steamliners that brought the troops home. And he'd tell the story that he won like five grand playing craps on the boat coming back.
Oh my goodness!
And he had an eighth grade education, so he used that money actually coming back from the war to start a butcher shop, and he raised a family. But
five grand back in the that's a lot of money. Amazing.
But he was, like so many people in Missouri, he's just got a great history of men and women who've served our country in the military, and that's, you know, I was the oldest grandchild, so I could have some conversations with him. But like a lot of people in that generation, he didn't talk about it a lot. My dad was the one that really kind of was able to have those conversations growing up. They had a butcher shop, and so all the kids worked in the butcher shop. So my dad would kind of ask them questions here or there, and those stories have been passed on. But, you know, just remember that greatest generation that stepped up and literally saved the world, liberated a continent, saved the world. So very proud of that. And I try to keep that in mind. My grandfather being an infantry guy, essentially carrying out the orders of the generals on being on the Armed Services Committee, I kind of keep that in mind with a lot of the questions that I'll ask of the top brass. Like, you know, I try to take that perspective of just the soldier and wanting to understand, okay, why are we doing this? And can we do this better? Or what mistakes were made? And so my grandfather still kind of lives with me in that way in my time here. And then as far as getting into politics, I was a lawyer and I loved that. I loved it. And I was focused on that and making partner and raising a family. And our first son, Stephen, was born. He was diagnosed pretty early on with a rare genetic condition. And so he's epilepsy and he's on the autism spectrum and nonverbal to this day. Stephen's 20. And seeing him go through that, including like hours long seizures, I began this process of kind of discernment and what did I really want to do with my life? And so public service was the avenue that I chose to kind of do something more. And it led me to this. So I'm very grateful for Stephen. To this day, he's kind of the touchstone in our lives.
Great hit. And you've served pretty much every level of elected office. I mean, from even the alderman level up to state senate.
Yeah, somebody talked me into being an alderman. I didn't know what that meant. And then I served in the state senate for 8 years in kind of St. Louis area, and then was in statewide office. Most recently was attorney general in Missouri for 4 years and led the charge on like vaccine mandate cases and free speech cases, the Missouri versus Biden and some of the craziness that happened in COVID and then the excesses of the Biden administration and all that. So we kind of led the charge nationally. And then Senator Blunt announced his retirement and there's a 21 person crazy primary in Missouri and won. And then, and so now this is my third year here in the Senate and just incredibly grateful. And by the way, all those experiences, I'm glad I've had them because they kind of inform whether it's from the legislative side or just having a state view of things or as AG, seeing how the federal government interacts with state government and now being here in the Senate. I'm very grateful for those experiences.
That's awesome. And you're on one of the most powerful committees in the Senate, the Armed Services Committee. And you talked a little bit about that. I wanted to, for folks watching at home, if you could share what you see the role of the Armed Services Committee is and making sure that our Department of Defense is on track, make sure that our country is prepared for the next threat that could emerge. How do you see your role in the committee and what should folks know at home about what you do here?
Yeah, the three big committees that I'm on are, I'm kind of you know, Washington and the federal government does a lot of things it shouldn't do, but some of the things it should do is national defense, I'm on armed services, interstate commerce, I'm on the Commerce Committee, and then the Judiciary Committee, sort of the Article 3 branch. So I feel like at least I'm in the constitutional zone with the committees that I'm on. But yeah, the armed services one, I got on as a freshman, which is kind of unusual, but really grateful for it, and is really, you come in with ideas, but I think in that committee in particular, the ability and willingness to listen is really important, because there's a lot of public hearings, there's a lot of classified briefings with the clearance that you have. So you learn a lot, and you want to take that knowledge and sort of put it into action of how we can keep our country safe and how we can do everything we can for the men and women who've chosen to serve their country. And that kind of sacrifice, the willingness to sort of put their lives on the line for everybody else, is kind of a solemn duty of that committee. So yeah. I think for me, the recognition that we're in a this great powers competition with China, the 21st century is really going to be defined by who wins that. Is the United States of America, or is it communist China? And there, and we've never really had a peer like this, in the sense that it's a, not only is a nuclear power, it's a military power, it's also an economic power. So even with the Soviet Union, they weren't really an economic rival. They were a military rival, they were a nuclear rival, but we've not really had another country like this that we've had to deal with. And I think recently you've seen, they've kind of shown their fangs. I mean, they're for real in space. They've built islands in the South China Sea. They've got hypersonic missiles. They have a bigger navy than we have, not a better navy, but a bigger navy. Their shipbuilding capacity dwarfs ours. And so, in some ways, the United States of America took its eye off the ball for a long time, and I think there is a bipartisan recognition of that dynamic with us and China. So then the question becomes, what do you do about it? And I think it's having this kind of, you know, we want to protect the homeland, but also recognize our chief threat. And so what do we need to do to meet the moment? And so that means being more nimble in procurement. It means sort of questioning some assumptions and getting reformers in the Pentagon, where they're making a lot of these decisions that for a long time were kind of clumsy and bulky and awkward. We've got to be better than that. You know, if you're talking about drone technology, for example, 6 months from now, it's outdated, right? So you can't have a bureaucracy that inhibits that kind of innovation. In many ways, China's been, they're not really great innovators, but they're great copiers. And so our advantage has been on the innovation side. But if you have a Pentagon that's kind of stifling innovation, we lose that advantage. So that's been the focus of a lot of what we do. And then, of course, you know, maintaining our superiority, our submarine class is the best in the world. Our fighters and our bombers are. And so we've been working on sort of the next generation aircraft. St. Louis is the home of Boeing and their military operations. So St. Louis is going to be building the F-47, which is exciting. And but those are the kind of decisions that that leaders have to make and stepping in. And so working with this administration now and Secretary Hegseth, they've been very open and accessible to kind of new ideas. And that's what we need right now.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with the emerging threat. I mean, we have to be able to keep pace. And I think the procurement issue is a big part of that. And so what have you done here in the Senate that is focused on that? And what are the questions that you're asking when you have people that come in, especially the last 4 years under the Biden administration? We saw just the disaster, you know, that happened at the Pentagon during those times. Can you talk a little bit about how you address that and kind of how you hold a lot of the top brass to account on some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is cultural, right? Much of these things that we're talking about is the Defense Department understanding the changing environment and the ability and willingness to adapt to it. Because, you know, this model that was created that worked for a long time during the Cold War is very outdated now. And so, and not just giving lip service to it, but actually implementing those kinds of reforms. And so some of the things that we're talking about is, you know, you've got the big primes and they do a great job, but you have to have an ecosystem of whether it's startups or smaller companies that could be part of that defense industrial base that makes it more resilient. And so whether that's grant funding, so there's a little bit more certainty, whether it's kind of some of the regulations like these sort of regulations that are a barrier to entry for smaller contractors, we got to reform that kind of stuff. And the NDA, the good news is, the one thing that still works in Congress, and there aren't a lot of things that work, is every year, and I think it's 64 straight years, we do an NDAA, a National Defense Authorization Act, where you sit in a room with Republicans and Democrats and you outline on the Armed Services Committee, what are the priorities of the United States from a military perspective, from a Defense Department? And so some of the reforms, we were kind of ahead of the game. I'm glad Pete Hegseth is getting rid of sort of this DEI obsession that the military had, right? We need to focus on merit. That's happening. I think that's an important cultural reform. I also think this procurement piece that that we've started on, but my guess is it'll be kind of supercharged this year, will be very important because it kind of sets the stage for the important weapon systems that we need to develop in the future. So, and also, I think moving some of the thinking and the innovation outside of the coasts, you know, we're talking about having defense tech hubs throughout the country to kind of encourage that kind of innovation in so-called flyover country too.
Yeah. And on the innovation piece, because you also sit on the Commerce Committee, Commerce, Science, and Technology. Can you talk a little bit about how the your work on that committee in particular is looking at emerging threats and how we can innovate and make sure that we're keeping a pace? What does that look like from your perspective?
It's actually a great question because I think there's a handful of us that both serve on the Commerce Committee and the Armed Services Committee. So there's certain things like spectrum, like, you know, when you're accessing, you know, Wi-Fi or that there's a push and pull a little bit on the commercial side versus the defense side that you try to balance those interests for national security. But I would say maybe the best example is probably in space because, you know, the first shots in the next big war are going to be fired in space because it's all about seeing things, having that kind of advantage. Because if the United States ever enters, we want to enter with overwhelming force where our war fighters are in the best position possible, right? And a lot of that is just sort of intelligence and what you see. And that's evolved a lot since when my grandfather served in World War II, right? And so the commercial side on commercial space innovation is really kind of leading. You know, NASA now has a very different role than it used to have. But you see companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX really kind of leading the way on this. And one example of that is, so just think of the satellite constellation and networks that they're not like a one-off anymore. Like you've got, you know, a bunch of these going up now that create some resilience. So if you're trying to blind the other side, it's not as easy as taking out one satellite if you've got this kind of constellation that exists. And really on the commercial side, they're innovating. And we need to maintain that advantage with China. We need to make sure that innovation is happening here. They're not far behind. I mean, they're playing for real, but we've got to maintain that advantage. And then also with AI, you know, you've got on the commercial application side, but then on the military side, that stuff, it's existential. Like you can't lose, yeah. Right? You can't lose. That's how civilizations come and go, is you have the technological advantage. So I would say being on those two committees gives you some insight and we're working to make sure we maintain that innovative advantage.
Yeah. One thing we've noticed, and we talked a lot about this at Veterans on Duty, is under President Biden, we saw a lot of the recruitment numbers for our military fall quite precipitously, actually. And matter of fact, we had one of the worst recruitment crises since the all-volunteer force, many decades ago. Now, so when we look now, though, since President Trump has come into office, we've seen these numbers really bounce back in a lot of ways. A lot of people are raising their right hand and are serving our country, which is really heartening for a lot of us to care. So why do you think that is? And what do you think is going to inspire the next generation into service, into considering the military?
I think it's our military has been the greatest meritocracy in the history of the world, in the sense that didn't matter, it doesn't matter, it shouldn't matter. What your background is, your race, anything like that, that you can rise. My grandfather had an eighth grade education and, you know, served in the war honorably, right? But people from all backgrounds have had ticker tape parades in New York. And that's the kind of upward mobility you can see through military service, that you want to attract the people who are service-minded, who want to serve their country. And there's a lot of pride that goes in that. And so I think part of what happened under the Biden years was, again, this obsession with DEI and kind of dividing the room by oppressor and oppressed. Like, this isn't a social experiment, right? This isn't some white paper. This is life and death, not just for the people who are serving, but for the country. And
hugely distracting.
It is a big distraction and really politicized something that shouldn't be political at all, right? And so I think that's a big part of the culture shift. I think the other thing I would mention, I think what we saw in COVID, right? It became, you know, you had 8,000 really qualified men and women who were fired.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, that they didn't want to take the COVID shot, right? So again, this kind of, I think, politicization that you saw in those 4 years, it infected every institution. You saw the weaponization of the Justice Department. And then, you know, the last place that stuff should ever go is in our military. And I think that affected recruiting. I mean, we had people come to us who said, this is what's going on and it's troubling. And I've kind of, you know, you kind of saw it also with law enforcement. You know, law enforcement was kind of under attack by the left and by prosecutors who didn't want to prosecute crime. There's a morale issue there. And I think when you have leaders who understand what the job entails and why it's important to have standards and be proud of that, I think you attract people who want to join. And you see record recruitment numbers now. I don't think that's any accident, right? So that's a good thing. And we should be proud of that.
That's really cool. Have there been any moments that you've experienced here in the Senate that have really resonated with you and have reminded you of just the importance of serving our country in elected office and having good leaders like yourself making a difference?
You know, for me, I guess circling back to your first question, last year I went to Normandy for the 85th anniversary of D-Day. And, you know, my grandfather was D-Day plus 40 or something like that. So it wasn't first day. But that's where they came through, and you just see the topography of that place. And you know, I'm a history guy, so you can read all you want about it, but seeing it and understanding that in June there were 2 days where you're going to have low tide, which is what Eisenhower's looking for, and the risk that it could have been a cataclysmic failure, right? Like we look back on World War II like it was an inevitability, but at the time in early June of 1944, it didn't always look that way, right? And so just the risk and the sacrifice that people made and being over there and, you know, and they take you to some graves where you take sand from the beach and you fill it in on the names. And so that was a pretty powerful thing to go to these Missouri graves. And, you know, their names, there aren't any, you know, statues in this town dedicated to those individuals, but they deserve our respect and to be remembered. And so that was a pretty powerful thing. And just thinking of my family story along the way I think for me brought it all home of why this is important, right? To prevent anything, we want to have peace through strength, so that we don't have young men and women who are, you know, going on a beach like that ever trying to save a continent again.
Absolutely. Well, thinking about Missouri, you know, I've been there a few times. I wanted to hear, are there any for veterans in particular who are going to visit or might be stationed there, where are there some places that you'd recommend veterans stop by, or even some veteran-owned businesses in Missouri that you care about, that you want to highlight for our team?
Well, you got to get to Busch Stadium. I mean, you got to see the Cardinals. They you see the Treat the Veterans Right. And I actually think one of the cool things now, I'm a big sports guy, so you know, the Mizzou now being in the SEC and they're a series player. Those are fun things to be at. Sports to me is a great distraction from what I like do 24/7. It feels like sometimes. So, where it isn't about politics at all. Like I don't care who's sitting next to me. If the Cardinals were winning the division or going to the World Series, I'm hugging the guy or gal next to me and we're all on the same team. I think sports kind of bring people together, but I've noticed, which I think is kind of cool. At games now, they're honoring military members, right? And not just to like just everybody stand up and let's clap, but like individual people. And I think that's kind of a cool development. So there's a lot of things, a lot of great barbecue in Missouri for people to enjoy. But Missouri's got a really proud tradition, not just the people who've served, but we've got Whiteman Air Force Base, which is the home of the B-2 stealth bomber. The B-21's coming, which is the next generation stealth bomber. You've got Fort Leonard Wood there, where there's a lot of training that happens.
It's a freeze there.
Yeah. And then St. Louis is kind of, like I said, it's been this kind of tech hub for weapons systems and aircraft for generations, going back to McDonnell Douglas days. So it's got a big footprint in Missouri, and representing Missouri here on the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, you get a chance to advocate for not just the assets that we have, but for the people who serve, which is kind of cool.
Well, as we close, one of the kind of traditions that we have here on the series is that we always like to hear from our guests about a challenge coin that maybe you might have been given that means something to you, and maybe there's a story attached to that. I don't know if you brought one with you today.
I did, because I heard about this.
So, awesome. So this is the biggest, most beautiful challenge coin you can have. So this is what President Trump has in the Oval Office.
That is
it awesome. Is pretty cool. I mean, it's enormous.
I've seen a lot of challenge coins. This one is has to be the coolest one I've seen. That is cool. Amazing.
So you know, just getting to know him, I traveled a lot on the campaign trail, and he just loves America. I mean, honestly, when you break it all down, He loves his country and, you know, executed this great political comeback. So getting to know him and working with him and his team on a lot of priorities has been a lot of fun. And, you know, I approach all this with a lot of humility. You know, I grew up in a working class family. I'm pretty sure I never thought I'd be in this position, and to have the chance to work on issues that matter for real people. I try to keep that top of mind. I know that's top of mind for him. So last time I was over there, I got one of these. So I figured this will be good to bring out. Otherwise, it just sits in my office. Now I get to show it off.
That was a good one. Well, and to add to your collection, we too wanted to give you our own coin here from Veterans on Duty. And it says Beyond the Call, our series in the bag. We want to thank you for all that you do for our country, for Missouri, and really for making sure that our country is prepared for the next fight. It really means a lot to have leaders like you who are making a difference.
Well, thanks for your service. And I know the organization's doing great work, and I just really appreciate the service of people who, and I think, I don't know, I try to, when you see somebody in an airport or wherever, or, you know, just acknowledging the service and thanking them, I think goes a long way. And so for all those who serve or watching, thanks for what you do.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you.
Here at Veterans on Duty, we are a policy advocacy organization focused on making sure our military is strong, lethal, and focused. All of that, of course, is about making sure America is safe, strong, and free. Those are the values that we hold dear at Vets on Duty, and that's why we're going to be sitting down with different leaders, veterans, policymakers, even some elected officials in our Beyond the Call video series. Stay tuned and join us.